From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I spent much of the summer transfixed by this year's pair of Phoebes, who nested on the back porch as usual and from a favorite low perch just across the way from there, launched themselves repeatedly into midair to catch insect after insect. How birds get their food and what birds eat anyhow is the subject of today's show, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
How do birds get their food? Well, that depends on the bird, and to help us answer, my guest today is Ellen Blackstone of BirdNote. A million people a day in more than 200 radio markets hear the two-minute public radio show called Bird Note, and now Bird Note's a book, too, which Ellen edited. Welcome, Ellen. I'm so glad to finally talk to you on the air. How are you?
Thanks, Margaret. I'm great. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
The book is so much fun.
We had fun doing it. It was hard work. We had to translate the book from the stories from the radio presentation to the printed page, but it was really fun.
Yeah, and I love the fact that they're illustrated. The illustrations are very charming. I was at a friend's house recently, not far from me, a farmer friend, and she had it on the dining table. And I said, "Where'd you get that?" And she said, "I took it out of the library. It looked so good."
Wow, in the library. We're happy to hear that.
In Nowheresville, New York, we had it in the library.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I was mentioning Phoebes, a kind of flycatcher, I guess, yeah, in the intro. And are they a flycatcher? I can't remember. No, they're not really. Well, what are they? Are they a flycatcher? Yeah.
It's a flycatcher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so who else sort of grabs dinner out of thin air like that?
Swallows and swifts.
Uh-huh.
Hummingbirds.
Yeah.
Mississippi kites, raptors that are, you know, big, like hawk-sized birds, grab dragonflies out of the air, and cicadas and so forth.
And then, of course, there are the naughty big birds who grab other birds out of the air. They're not really naughty, but that can be a little shocking at the first time you see that happen when
yes,
a Cooper's
nature.
Hawk or someone comes and gets a little songbird. Yeah,
nature at its most shocking sometimes.
So you said swallows.
Barn swallows that might nest over your porch, cliff swallows that might nest on the side of a barn or a building, you know, with their mud nests. All of them eat and drink on the wing, and a lot of them mate on the wing as well. So spend their entire lives in the air.
Birds eat so many different things. So barn swallows, for instance, they would be going after insects, yeah?
Right.
Yeah.
People kind of curse them for the mess they leave on the porch, but they should be grateful because they eat so many mosquitoes.
Yeah. I mean, as I said in the introduction, I mean, watching the Phoebes, you know, they're very systematic and they know how to do it. I don't know if the parents teach them or if it's just innate. I don't know in that particular species, but wow, you know, they have a particular perch and they use that spot and it's their spot and they have their little sort of circle that they fly, you know, to catch those insects. And it's really, as I said, systematic. It's fascinating, right, to watch.
Right. And they're beautiful little birds, I think. Both the eastern version and the birds in the west are gorgeous little birds.
So you have a Phoebe? Do you?
We have Say's Phoebes and Black Phoebes out here.
Right, so, and you're in the Seattle area, yes, specifically?
Right.
Yeah. And we should say to people, Bird Note really started as kind of an offshoot, I think, from Seattle Audubon. Is that right?
That's right. The executive director of Seattle Audubon at the time had heard a program about astronomy called Stardate and thought, oh, we can do that for birds. And went to her local NPR station, and they said, yeah, we'll carry it. And just that encouragement got her started, and she put together the team.
I love BirdNote, of course. And one of the most fun things since I've had my website, my little funny garden website, was when I discovered it and then reached out to you, and we became kind of pen pals, and you helped me, pen pals and Skype pals, and you helped me to kind of do, we used to do a series together of, you know, based on audio, little two-minute bird note episodes, we would do sort of Q&A together, and that was fun. So I'll remind people and give some links to some of those with the transcript. But that was really fun. I learned a lot. I mean, that was where I learned, I believe, from you, was that hummingbirds, which I think of as nectar eaters, right, that they also eat some insects. I don't think I knew that.
Right, you know? The picture that the baby birds need protein as they're growing. So the mama hummingbird, and it is only the mama hummingbird, feeds the babies a mixture of insects of all sorts, spiders and creepy crawly things, and nectar.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah. So birds eat so many different things, as I was saying before, you know, so sort of we've been talking about from insects. And I think among songbirds, I think most are at least partly insectivorous. I think that's a fair statement. Certain birds specialize in fruit, seeds. We mentioned birds who eat other birds. some birds eat roadkill. Now, I know you're a crow and raven person, so just let's give them a little shout out for their bizarre diet.
Right. Part of nature's cleanup crew along with the vultures. Absolutely.
Yeah. It is quite amazing. I remember, I think it was, who was it? It was from New Jersey Audubon, the great ornithologist from the Audubon in New Jersey, who told me the reason that vultures have those naked heads is because if you were going to stick your head in a carcass for dinner, you wouldn't want to have a lot of feathers on it. I mean, he said it in a little more elegant way than I just did. Right?
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Right. They all of them have naked heads.
And some birds even really eat, you know, kind of other things that we might think of are gross, like hairy, squirming things like some kinds of caterpillars, like tent caterpillars. Tell us about that.
There's a story in the book about cuckoos eating hairy tent caterpillars. And both the yellow-billed and the black-billed cuckoos, which the black-billed cuckoos are a little farther north, but you might have yellow-billed cuckoos. Both of them eat tent caterpillars. And they're hairy, as you know. And when the hairy stuff builds up enough, they just regurgitate their entire stomach lining. Oof. And, yeah, I don't know exactly how it starts over. I haven't studied that part of the science.
Yeah.
But they just start over.
Wow. We have, when we had gypsy moth outbreaks in the Northeast, I don't know if you have gypsy moths in the West. You know, I'm not up on the sort of range of gypsy moths. But when we have those, and those have a kind of nasty caterpillar also, the two species of cuckoos that we have here, you'll see them, especially in like Connecticut, that'd be the nearest place where I've ever heard / seen them. They will be in a frenzy to enjoy those delicious morsels.
And they don't have much competition, probably.
I don't think anybody else wants to eat those. but caterpillars are a big important food for birds and for baby birds, yes?
Right. Not just tent caterpillars, all kinds of caterpillars, yes.
Right. Yeah. So without caterpillars, I think songbirds especially would be in big trouble.
Right. All those warblers that you see in the treetops are, you know, eating bugs from the tops and the bottoms of the leaves. And yep.
You just said warblers, and as I was driving over to the studio today, I saw a flash of some little warbler-like birds sort of at the road edge, you know, in sort of the thickety kind of areas, rushing around, flying around. And I was thinking, it feels like birds are on the move. Are you noticing any signs of, I mean, it's not fall yet, it's sort of mid to late August, but are you seeing any kind of sense of like departures where you are?
You know, I think part of what you see about migration is just what you describe, where you start seeing birds that you haven't seen.
Yeah.
And it's because they're passing through and they've stopped in your yard. For some reason, we have a hummingbird in the West called the rufous hummingbird, and they're already leaving. And of course, shorebirds head south in July from, you know, the ones that nest in the Arctic Circle and so forth. The adults head south in July. The young follow a couple of weeks behind, but shorebirds are on the move absolutely.
Hummingbirds. We only have the ruby-throated, and they. Starting in late July for me, early August for sure, early August, I see a lot more individuals and I see more males. I think the males head first. Do the males sort of go
first? I think
first?
You're right. They certainly come north first, and I think they head south first too.
Yeah, and I see, so they're not, quote, my hummingbirds that I've maybe had visiting that during the spring and summer. Their populations, they're individuals that have been coming from farther north and are already making the journey, and they stop in the garden, you know. It's kind of fun because I see the most right around this time of year into early September. I see many more individuals. In fact, this morning I was outside and I was just walking, going to get Tool out of the garage, and someone, I swear, almost hit me in the head with that hilarious sound, that really buzzing sound. I mean, there's nothing like that sound. And I thought, wow, I wonder what it's like to get hit in the head with a hummingbird.
I've always thought they can do that they do that on purpose, because sometimes they make the sound and sometimes they don't. So it feels to me like they're doing it on purpose, maybe just to bug you.
Yeah. So what about earthworms? There's a couple of places in the book I think that earthworms come into play as part of birds' diet. What about worms?
Right. Our lead writer, Bob Sundstrom, wrote a story called Earthworms, Underground Superfood or something like that.
Oh, and right. It's something like cold storage. Superfood and cold storage.
That's it.
Was that? Yeah. That made me laugh.
That they, when it's cold, they do go farther into the ground. So when you see your robin running on the lawn in the spring, it's not an accident, you know, that the robins are back just about the time the earthworms are ready to come up a little closer to the surface. But, you know, we know they don't die off. They just dig down. And yes, the cold storage is a beautiful image, isn't it?
Yeah, not exactly what I'm putting in my pantry for the winter, however. I'm sorry. I'd prefer not to. Any other? So robins are in particular eat worms. I was trying to think of any other birds, if I've ever seen any other birds go after worms, but I guess not really.
You mentioned crows. Crows eat worms.
Oh yes, of course. Okay. Well, they eat anything, don't they?
They do. They love your lawn. They can just find all kinds of things in your lawn. If the garbage can is secured, they'll turn to your lawn for sure.
Any other sort of, from the book, are there kind of some favorite food-related stories that you want to share with us, like any that you particularly enjoyed or that are memorable?
You know, one of the ones that I like, and it's visual, and if you can find videos, you should definitely do that. A bird called a green heron, which is nothing like the great blue heron. It's much smaller, has a different body shape entirely. It baits its prey in the water. It will take a feather or a leaf or a twig or something like that and drop it in the water and watch it as it moves, and hoping a fish will come up wondering what that is, and then the heron will nab it. And it obviously does that on purpose.
Wow.
Amazing birds to watch, and beautiful birds.
So the green heron, it baits its prey.
Yes.
That's pretty crazy.
It is.
Pretty smart, huh?
Yes. Another one, we mentioned this bird earlier, the Mississippi kite, is an incredible acrobat on the wing as it goes after dragonflies and such. But when it migrates, at the same time that it's migrating, the green darner dragonfly migrates, and it's very handy food on the wing for the Mississippi kite.
Huh,
so the two critters are flying together.
So it's a concurrent kind of a well-timed...
Right.
And I guess that would have been sort of, they co-evolved to do that, yeah?
I mean, it's not
an accident.
I'm not
it can't
sure
be
why the green darner dragonfly wanted to do that evolutionarily, but yes, I think you're right.
Huh. Yeah, that's really interesting. That reminds me of the, I'm going to get this probably imprecise because I'm no ornithologist over here or entomologist, but the sapwells that I think the yellow-bellied, well, we have the yellow-bellied sapsucker here, open up when the males come into their breeding grounds and they open up, you know, the sapwells, and how other birds sort of follow them at that time, I think, because they know they're going to be able to get to take advantage of that. And when I say no, I don't mean no as in they all talked about it or they studied it in school or something. But do you know what I mean? There's other opportunities that two species seem to know about, and they do concurrent behaviors that are always fascinate me when I read about that.
Absolutely. And one of those is hummingbirds.
Right.
Because of all the insects that are drawn to the sapwells. And, you know, the hummingbirds will often be in attendance with the sapsuckers.
Do you have sapsuckers in the West, in the Northwest?
Yes, we have red-naped and red-breasted sapsuckers and Williamson sapsuckers that are sort of localized in the mountains.
Huh. Yeah, so that ruby-throated hummingbird will come to the sapwells, and then later on that the yellow-bellied makes. And I have for me, the yellow-bellied are resident because I'm in the breeding area as well as the, you know, where they live the rest of the time. I think the sapsuckers don't migrate as much as the others, but I don't know exactly. Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they do migrate more. But I'm in a breeding area, is all I'm saying. So I always have sapsuckers, much to the dismay of some of my ornamental trees, by the way, in the garden.
And you've seen the hummingbirds at the sapwells?
Yeah, fun. I've seen. And certain butterflies use the sapwells later on. So it's very interesting. Something will catch your eye. It looks like, why is that other creature at the bark of a tree? And do you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense. It's not a leaf. It's not a flower. It's bark. And then you realize what's going on. yeah, it's pretty cool. Other good ones?
There are two birds that come to mind. One is the brown creeper, which you always see going up the trunk of a tree. And a nuthatch, which you always see going down. And they're finding different things, though, especially the nuthatch that's going down. Sees totally different things than the bird going up sees, because its perspective looking down into the bark, it sees all different insects that the bird moving up the trunk misses.
You know the brown creeper. We did a story together about the brown creeper, and that's just one of my favorite birds. I think because it seems sort of shy, and it's not conspicuous, but it's very beautiful.
It so blends in with the trunk of a tree, it's very hard to see, I think.
Yeah. And then the nuthatches are a little more, you know, you see them about and they're a little more talky and so forth, at least for me. Do you have both there in the Northwest?
We have mostly the red-breasted, yank, kind of
that
kind
nasal.
Of monotonous.
They're nasal, aren't they? They are
nasal.
Yeah. So the nuthatch kind of travels down the tree, kind of looking. Are they looking like under the bark, or what are they doing?
Yeah, they're getting the bugs that have been left by woodpeckers and brown creepers and other birds that work their way up the tree. Because you don't see woodpeckers working their way down a tree.
No.
You know, you see them working up or around, and then when they get to a certain point that they can't move, they'll mostly fly. They won't go down.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, picture everything that's left for those little nuthatches that are looking down into crevices.
Yeah, and the brown creeper.
Nobody's eaten that stuff yet.
Yeah, and the brown creeper, I mean, when it finishes, when it gets all as far up as it's going to go, it, like, goes back down to the bottom and starts again sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Determination. So those are some good ones. Any others that on your list?
There's a gull. Some of the birds that work together. They're Harris's hawks that hunt together, which is unusual when you picture raptors. And there's a gull called the Bonaparte's gull, which I think is the smallest gull in North America. It's a beautiful little bird with a black hood during breeding season. A lot of them, they'll gather in a group and sort of dance at the water's edge, and it fluffs up shrimp and other little crustaceans. In the book, we call it a chorus line.
That is funny.
They're sweet little birds, too. They're beautiful.
So they sort of flush out by dancing at the edge of the water. They sort of flush out these crustaceans that they want to eat?
Right.
Oh, that makes me think of the, is it the, is it the Redstart or the Blackburnian? I think it's the Redstart, the little warbler, that sort of flushes its tail to get to sort of scare insects out of the branches. Do you have that? Maybe you don't have that bird, but
no, we don't have that bird.
And it does this crazy. It spreads its tail, and it's very dramatic, almost like I call it a fan dance. Of course, it's not a fan dance, but that's what it looks like. And it's a device like what you're just saying to get the desired prey in reach. Do you know what I mean? To stir it up.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Right. That's interesting.
Another one similar to that is a phalarope. There are three species, I think, of phalaropes that go in circles. And they do that same thing. They start a swirl that brings food up to them. And it's very funny to see these birds spinning around in circles.
I don't know about that bird. Where is it? What kind of big, little? What's it like?
It's probably about maybe 12 inches long, something like that. It's a good sized bird, shorebird.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a shorebird. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. We have a few minutes left, and I want to just ask you kind of a little bit about the book in general. Like, how long did you all work on it? The project must have been kind of epic because you have a lot of years. How many years of Bird Note programs?
We started in 2005.
Yeah.
Yeah. More than 1,500 shows.
Yeah, and these are like two-minute sort of segments. Are they 2 minutes? Is that right, or did I make that up?
No, they were 2 minutes, and they're now a minute 45.
Yeah.
We had to cut it a little while ago.
Yeah.
So obviously the first task was to pick 100 stories out of 1,500, which was no easy task.
Who's going to make the cut? Yeah.
Right. So we went after unusual behavior, more common species, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And a variety of birds.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I mentioned, rewriting the stories because they were originally written for radio and had sound breaks for sound.
Right.
And oftentimes had first-person elements that are appropriate on a radio story, but not so much on the printed page.
Right.
So we had to rewrite those for the printed page. And editing back and forth, Sasquatch Books was just amazing to work with. We were so excited to be working with them on that.
They do a lot of interesting things about or by experts in the Pacific Northwest, right? I mean, it's an interesting company. I've enjoyed many of their cookbooks and so forth. I have some friends who do cookbooks with them. Yeah.
Yes, I was going to say, I think you'd love the cookbooks. There are a few sort of gardening books or books about foraging.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've seen a few of them. Well, I love this different incarnation of Bird Note. You know, I'm so used to hearing it out loud, but it's kind of fun to sit with it and be able to, just browse through and sample some of the best of. As the cover says, it says Bird Note chirps, quirks, and stories of 100 birds from the popular public radio show. Ellen Blackstone, I'm so glad to, as I said, finally speak to you out loud on the air. So thank you for making the time today. And thanks for the book. It's great.
So happy to be here. Thanks, Margaret.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And thanks to all the rest of you, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and birding meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.